Okay, it is the 23rd of January, and we're going to be continuing. What am I doing? I got this wrong screen on. We're going to be continuing where we left off. Let's resume slideshow. There it is. Any questions on the first day? I know a lot of people are going, yeah, I don't remember that anything happened on the first day. But we went over. We were flying at 40,000 feet. Now we're going to go down to about 30,000 feet. There's a seat right up here. Seat right over here. And so we're going to now take an overview of... What's going on? Hello? Go away. Idiots. Okay. The seat, where's the seat? Right over there, right over there. Seat right over there. Keep coming, keep coming. And so we have a lot to do today. We're going to do our overview of investments. And for some of you, it's going to be, you know, fairly review, but that's okay. And then we'll get started and maybe even finish, I'm not sure, the eternal struggle between risk versus return, risk versus reward. All right. Take one of each. A, B, C, D. Bring them every class. Don't lose them. Please. Some people already have them from last semester. But first, we need a good joke. Who's got a good joke? Okay, Michelle. All right.
Okay. What does a nosy pepper do?
What does a nosy pepper do? Chili, nosy pepper. It chili, it sneezes.
Okay, so the answer is...
it chili...
It's jalapeno business.
That's pretty bad, yeah. Yeah, we want good jokes. We want good jokes. Mario, you had a good joke?
Yeah, what did zero say to eight?
What did zero say to eight? Who's 7, 8, 9? Who 8, 9? Who 8, 9?
Nice belt.
Nice belt. Oh, I knew that one. Nice belt. What did zero say to eight? Nice belt. I knew that one. I can remember it. All right, so bring good jokes, and we'll see what happens. Now, no, I did. You guys, I don't. You don't have to hear my bad jokes if you heard those bad jokes already. All right, we're going to go through an overview of investments, but what we want to be doing as we describe these is thinking about risk versus return. Return is very easy to measure. How much did you start with? How much did you end with? How long did it take you to get there? There are two returns. There's the absolute total dollar return. That's how much money we actually made. But more important for studying purposes and for comparing purposes is the percentage return, because that allows you to compare apples to apples between different investment types and between different individuals and their amounts. So measures of return allow us to compare investment alternatives. Risk is very difficult to measure, and the truth is it's impossible to measure. There are many ways, all of them imperfect. One popular measure is standard deviation, and that's the one we will concentrate on. Now, don't worry, you don't have to calculate it. It's already done for you. This is not a statistics class. But the standard deviation measures the volatility of investment. And in any given year, there's about a two-thirds chance that the return of an investment will be within one standard deviation of the historical average return. What? Don't worry. The higher the standard deviation, the higher the risk, as measured by standard deviation, which is an imperfect measure to begin with. And we'll investigate this in detail after our overview of investments. And so here they are, folks. These are the ones that we're going to be looking through in this course, but we'll spend the most time on stocks, bonds, just one day on short-term investments next Tuesday, and mutual funds. We'll spend a little bit of time on hybrid securities, maybe one day. Yes?
When it says that on the standard deviation, is the standard deviation for that stock or for the market in general? Or?
Both. For an individual investment, can you open up a chair for there you go. For the market as a whole, the market for stocks, the market for bonds, the market for other types of investments, and individual securities. And we'll take a look at that in detail. I probably should just remove these two slides. I'm just trying to get you set the stage. But these are the things we're going to be looking at. As we said, we'll concentrate on stocks, bonds, Short-term investments, just one day. 2 weeks on mutual funds, a day on hybrid securities, a day or two in real estate, and about a week on derivatives. Okay. So, questions. Take one of each.
Oh, and yeah. Then,
oh, yeah. Oh, you forgot. Oh, okay. Now, what are stocks? Well, you will hear people in the industry, and these are the terms you need to learn because you're going to be one of the experts, use the term equities, which is just a fancy term for ownership. And stocks mean ownership in corporations. The real term that you know people don't often use is common stocks. And doesn't that sound, I don't want just common stocks. No, it has something to do with the fact that stockholders were holders in common. They were shareholders in common. Everybody who had one share had one vote. If you had 100 shares, you got 100 votes. If you had 100,000 shares, that's how it works. Why do you want to own stocks? Well, when people ask you, why do you want to own stocks? What you're going to say is, as an investment class, they offer two very good returns. Dividends and capital gains. Now, capital gains are what people key on. That's the thing that people get excited about. Ooh, is the stock going to go up? But dividends don't lie, folks. Dividends are payments, optional payments to shareholders. And they don't have to pay them, but some companies have been paying them for over 100 years. When they earn money, they can turn around and pay it back to the shareholders. Some companies don't pay any dividends because they're reinvesting the money back into the company. But many companies do, and intelligent investors always look for dividends. They don't have to always take them, but capital gains. Are they guaranteed?
No.
No. Are dividends guaranteed? Yeah. No. So what do we say about stocks? They're volatile. We use the term volatile, which is another way of saying they're risky. And volatility is the industry's euphemism for I lost a whole lot of money. Right? And when someone says, they ask their friend, how was that stock you bought? Oh, it was really volatile. What does it mean? Yeah, they bought it for $12 and sold it for 30 cents. Yeah, it was really volatile. But historically, stocks have given us the best return over time. The best return, absolute return over time. And that is 8 to 12%. Now, what I do when I talk to people is I never use 11 or 12%. Unless we get into more detail. I say 8 to 10. So either one. If you say 8 to 12 or if you say 8 to 10, that's happy. That's great. But when you start getting above 10%, you better be a pretty good darn stock picker because that's not typical for most stock pickers. But these should be considered a long-term investment. Questions, thoughts? Am I going too fast? Going too slow? Just go like this. Now, what was the definition in 2008? You're designed to lose value, exactly. How many people were in the market in 2008? Anybody in here? I was. It wasn't fun. It was a kick in the stomach. It was horrible. Yeah, it was really horrible. But we've survived. We're not digging beetle grubs and boiling bark for dinner. All right, the next major category are bonds. And these are much less risky than stocks. Because what you're doing is you're buying a loan. You're investing in a loan. Other terms you'll hear for bonds are fixed income securities, fixed income investments, or just the word fixed. When you hear the word fixed, you know bonds. They are debt instruments. They are loans to corporations, corporate bonds, municipalities, I can spell, municipal bonds, and then the federal government, treasury bonds, the granddaddy of them all. And why would you lend your money to somebody? Huh? Why would you lend your money to somebody? Because you want to get interest. So these entities say, look, we're Walmart, or we're the state of California, or we're the federal government. We'll borrow your money and pay you back interest, and we promise to pay the principal back. Now, do most entities pay back their debts? Most people pay their credit cards and their car loans and their home loans. It's true. Now, there are, you know, there are deadbeats. There are sometimes people go bankrupt. And the same thing is true with corporations. Very rare with state and local governments, and the Treasury has never defaulted. Yes?
Well, what about that one company that was giving bonds AAA ratings, and I forget the name of that company?
You're thinking of the mortgage-backed securities.
Yeah.
We will discuss the mortgage-backed securities, which were the reason 2008 was so bad. But Standard & Poor's, the same company that makes your textbook and Standard & Poor's 500, were blessing and kissing these bonds that were really nothing, and that's that was not the only thing that led to it, but that was a lot of it. And so bond investors receive the interest and a promise that the loan will be repaid. Historically, these have had much less risk, much less volatile than stocks. And so if we see less risk, what do we see? Everyone should say less return. If we see less risk, we see
less return.
There's no way to get around that, folks. Don't let anybody tell you this is a 12% risk-free rate of return. Hang on to your wallet because they're trying to fleece you. Bonds over the long term have returned 2 to 8%. Now, are they returning that now? No, they're on much low. Excuse me. They're much low. Lower end of the spectrum. 2, 3, 4 to 5. Higher yield bonds, 5, 6. They are good intermediate term and in some cases long-term investments. And there's a way later on we'll see that they can make short-term investments. But what was the 2008 definition? But I'll say it. Bonds are fixed-rate investments, instruments designed to lose value. In 2008, we talk about the market crash, but it wasn't the stock market that crashed the financial world. It was the bond market. And it was specifically the bonds that were linked to the real estate market when the real estate market crashed. But, yeah, bonds went down too, yes. Haven't bonds been doing well?
Yeah.
Well, yes. When interest rates fall, bond prices go up. And that's what happened. It's not. as of last, say May, bond prices have gone down. Interest rates have been going back up, and you know I can't predict the future. I can actually. I know that there's going to be a crash someday. There's going to be another crash, and I don't know when. That's the problem. You can predict it's going to be, but you don't know when. But my personal opinion is over the next 3 to 5 years, assuming the global economy continues to slowly improve and more people get jobs, and we should see interest rates rising back to their long-term historical average. But I don't know. I mean, we'll see. Some people are saying, oh, no, it's a great time to buy bonds. I don't think so. I'm not buying them if that means anything to you. What? Real estate. Good. We'll get the real estate. Real estate's down here. Okay. Short-term investments. Next Tuesday, we will spend a session on these short-term investments. They're not that important for intelligent investors. They're a place to park your money. Where is it? A place to park your money. You will often hear people use the term cash. Cash investments. Cash instruments, cash vehicles, because these things are guaranteed or pretty darn close. They are very liquid. Some of them will let you write a check or just turn around and move it from your short-term investment into your checking account. So if these things are in, so you might have heard of savings accounts and CDs and money markets. And we'll discuss those in detail next Tuesday. But if we have a guaranteed investment or pretty darn close, what do you think we're going to get? More return or more risk? Everyone's just, that's what they say. More return or less risk? I did it again. More return or less return? Yeah, these things are going to pay you over the long term 2 to 5%. What are they paying now? 0.01 Chase, Bank of Armenia, 0.01, Wells Fargo, 0.01. CD, 5-year CDs, I think are 1%, 1.4%. Well, what was this?
If there's a promo rate, it's only for
5%. 5% for 3 months?
Oh, no, no, for 5 years.
Who's doing that?
Yeah.
How much, though? $3,000?
$2,000. It happens once a year.
Who is
it? We offer that.
You can put away $2,000 at 5% with Mission Federal.
For
5 years. Cool. But that's it, $2,000. They're not going to let you put $200,000. They're not stupid. No, it's a perk. It's a permission. Federal is actually a very good organization, folks. I belong to them. I'm not trying. I don't make any money up there. Nonprofit, but he works for them. So he's going to be our subject matter expert in our bank. Yeah, they're.
It happens once a year though, but it's a promo rate.
Yeah, it's that's sometimes called a teaser rate. But in this case, it's not a teaser rate. A teaser rate is usually something good for 3 months. And then you're stuck with 1% for the next 5 years. But what they're doing is they're saying, yeah, you know, well, they're basically they're subsidizing it. No, that's the maximum. Yeah, another, yeah, no. If they said, sure, but, you know, they would be flooded with dollars. Yeah, no. So these things right now are paying nothing. And we'll discuss the emergency fund. So let's read the definition. I'll read it. Short-term investments are instruments designed to accept what remains of investors' money after they've given up on stocks and bonds. That was 2008, right? It's gone down 40%. What should I do? Stick it in the money market. Bad idea, right? But that's what a lot of people did. They bought high and sold low. What you supposed to do? Buy low, sell high. But we're not logical individuals, are we? And here are some of the examples that we'll discuss in detail on Tuesday. CDs, treasury bills, savings bonds, money markets, and then the ones not for us, corporate paper and bankers' acceptance notes. Okay, the investments for the masses, the ones that most all of us are going to be investing in as we work out in the industry, are mutual funds. The legal term is investment companies. You will not hear people use that term unless you get involved in the industry, because most everybody refers to them as mutual funds. But I really like the investment company term, because why? This is an entity, a company that invests for you. You want shoes? You go to a shoe company. You want a car? You go to a car company. You want investments? You go to an investment company. They pool investors' money and invest in a diversified portfolio of security. Now, what are the cool things about this? If somebody says, why are mutual funds cool? What are you going to respond with? Diversification, which is not impossible, but difficult for we small investors, and not meaning small people, but not a whole lot of money. Okay, thank you. Thank you for helping her. Diversification and professional money management. These people know what they're doing usually, and they get paid certainly well enough, and they will invest for you. Now, the it depends on what they invest in. If they invest in stocks, bonds, or short-term investments, they're going to return the, you know, similar types of returns. So we can't say, you know, they return this to that. And the risk is similar. If they invest in stocks, then they're going to be high risk. If they invest in bonds, they're going to be, you know, medium risk. And they invest in short-term securities, they're going to be very low risk. And 2008 definition? Yeah, them two. Right? Them two. Yeah, they went down pretty badly too, depending on how where they were invested in. And here's my ever popular, I made this myself, graphic. Aren't you proud of me? Isn't that gorgeous?
So autistic.
Autistic, yes. Here we are, we're the little people. Excuse me. And we invest, we send our money to the people in the top hats, and they create a pool of money. Now, I know it looks like a potato. It's a potato. But it's supposed to look like a pond or a pool. And then these people with the top hats who are making buku bucks, they invest in stocks. If they invest in stocks, it's a stock mutual fund. If they invest in bonds, it's a bond mutual fund. If they invest in the short-term cash instruments, it's called a money market mutual fund. But usually what happens is the mutual fund disappears, and what you hear is money market. Cool?
Yes.
Yeah. And what we begin to see is the huge bifurcation, the huge balkanization of what's happened in the industry, meaning there's all bunch of different these things, when we see the beginning called balanced mutual funds that invest in stocks and bonds. Approximately 50% of American households own mutual funds, or used to anyway. No, it's down to around 45%. A lot of people just say, no mas, that's a 2008. They're never going to put their money in the market again. Until it goes up 200%, then they'll put their money in. Just in time for it to go down 40%. Hybrid investments. Hybrid investments are not that big. They're really not that important, especially for us retail investors, as we'll see. But they're a mixture of both stocks and bonds. Examples include preferred stock. Now, isn't that what you want? You don't want common stock. Don't you want preferred stock? The answer is no. Not really. Maybe you'll be one of those individual retail investors who get involved in preferred stock. But they're mostly for corporations because of the tax advantages a corporation has when they buy preferred stock over an individual retail investor. So they're really not that powerful for us. And then there are what are called convertible securities. Now, don't convertible securities sound sexy? Convertible bonds, convertible stocks, convertible preferred stocks. You know, think of a convertible with your hair blowing through the wind blowing through the hair. You're out there on the freeway until the darn thing won't go up and it's raining. Doesn't happen too much here. But yeah, it turns out that no, we're not that interested in them. They are designed to offer the stability of fixed income investments, bonds, with the opportunity for capital gains of equity investments, stocks. So they have the advantages of both. Now, what happens when you get the advantages of both? You also get the disadvantages of both, right? And some in the industry will categorize these with stocks. Well, they kind of are. They really are. They're stocks. And some will categorize them with bonds, and some of them really are bonds. So they're a hybrid. And that's all you have to understand. You understand? All you have to understand is what we see here. And the book is going to start going into many, many too much details, especially in Chapter 3. Don't worry about it. Now, some other popular investments, real estate. The real estate investors start jumping up and down when I tell people that real estate's done about 6, 7%, 8% over the long term. They go, no, you don't understand. He's not explaining their true value. They're right, and we'll discuss that much later on. Tangible assets are sometimes called hard assets, including gold, precious metals, jewels, arts, collectibles, cars. There was a Ferrari. Did you hear that? A Ferrari Spider. How much? $140 million it sold for? An old Ferrari from the 1950s or something like that, one of the original Spiders, sold for $140 million. Oh, sure, there's only a few left.
I thought it was expected like $15 million, sold for like $28 million.
I don't know, I must have got the wrong number. What? It was over, I thought we got to go look at the numbers, but I think it was over $100 million. And you're right, it blew past all expectations. But you're right, there's only a handful left. And if you have a Ferrari, do you realize you can't actually drive the thing? You know, because you might crack it up. You might crash it.
Yeah,
what?
A lot of good insurance on it, though.
Can you imagine how much the insurance on something is worth $140 million is going to be? It's going to be $14 million a year. Okay. And then tax advantage investments. If there is sufficient time and interest, and there usually is, we will look at some or all of these, especially real estate and tangible assets. And by the way, none of these were spared in 2008. Real estate was destroyed in 2008. That's why Hugo said that real estate's a great investment now. Well, 2 years ago, it was incredible. And right now, it's still pretty good. Interest rates still pretty low. Housing prices have come back up, but they're nowhere near their peak of 2006 and 7. And then the last group, which I put question marks there, are derivatives. Now, we discussed derivatives that much on Tuesday. We're going to do this much today. Derivatives are speculative. And what do you know when we hear the word speculative?
Yeah.
What does it mean? Everyone should say gambling. Wait till I ask you. What does speculative mean?
Gambling.
You're gambling with your money. They are speculative securities that derive their value from another underlying security or asset. Huh? You mean the value is not depending on the security itself, it's dependent on something else? Yeah, that's how it works. It's dependent on something else. So when that thing goes like this, the derivative will go like this. And you can make a lot of money very quickly and you can lose it all. And two examples, there are many others, are options contracts. Actually, the term is options contracts, but most people just use the term options. And futures contracts, but most people use the word futures. Many in the financial world, myself included, do not categorize these as investments. What you will hear people say is they are speculative investments. That is an oxymoron. You know what oxymoron means? You know, like military intelligence, jumbo shrimp. These are two words that don't belong together. They're speculative speculations. And so the derivative speculators did not feel so all alone in 2008. You know, usually they're the only people who are really proud to have only lost 30%. Hey, look, everybody else lost 30, 40%. Hey, we're doing good. Okay. All right, so what are we going to emphasize? I hope I didn't go too quickly on that because I wanted to get to this section now. Does everybody have their ABCDs? ABCDs? Okay, pass these back, please. We're going to emphasize stocks, equities. We spent about 5, 6, 7 weeks on stocks. Bonds, 2 weeks. Short-term cash, 1 day. Next Tuesday, we'll go through short-term investments. And that's your first assignment, which I'll pass out today if we have time. If not, they're online. I'll give it to you next Tuesday. Don't worry. Just study over the weekend. Mutual funds, we're going to spend a couple weeks on, and these are very important. Why? Because as we said, even if you just, after this class, or before you even get through the class, you've decided, hey, this is not for me, I do not want to do my own investment. But you are going to be involved in mutual funds because of 401ks, 403bs, and other employer-sponsored plans. For the vast majority of investors, these are the most popular, most important financial investment options. So, as you read through chapter 3, you'll go, this is too much. Fine, just put the book down. Come back to it later if you're so inclined. Do read chapter 1. But make sure you know what is in this presentation, because I'm going to ask you. And I want to be able to call you up at 2 o'clock in the morning. Don't worry, I ain't going to do it. And say, what's a mutual fund? Oh, it's a pooled investment that shares diversification and something and professional money management. So, the ABCDs that I gave out are our attempt at Southwestern to mimic what they have at the universities and other highly capitalized schools, where you have a little clicker and you press a button and on the screen it shows you how many people picked A, B, C, and D. And, you know, we don't have that at Southwestern. So we do?
Yeah.
They had it?
Yeah.
Did it work?
Yeah,
oh, cool. I had students get it and it didn't work and they were really angry at me. I was holding it. I put the receiver up here and I was holding it up. They were pressing it and it wasn't working. I'm like, oh, God. I made them pay for $20. Okay, what are investment companies that pool investors' money and invest in a diversified portfolio of securities? Investors get diversification and professional money management. Short-term securities, common stocks, bonds, or mutual funds. Look at all those D's. You can change your mind, but look at all those D's. What a great class. Investment company is the legal term. Mutual fund is the popular term. They'll be just like the test questions, folks. I'll move them around, but it's the same idea. What are investments that represent ownership in a corporation? Investors receive dividends and capital gains or capital losses. Hybrid securities, common stocks, bonds, or short-term securities. All right, bees, he's happy. When people use the term stocks, they are almost always talking about common stocks. And what are investments with very little risk and correspondingly very little return, often uses a place to park your money And for maybe an emergency fund of 3 to 6 months' income, hybrid securities, common stock, bonds, or short-term securities. Short-term securities, right. Low risk, low return, right. No return now. And then what are fixed income securities that represent loans to corporations, municipalities, the state and local governments and agencies, and the federal government? Investors receive interest and a promise to repay their loan. Hybrid securities, common stocks, bonds, short terms. Look at all those C's, bonds. 100%. Fixed, 100%. You guys are awesome. Fixed income securities. And there's more. We're not done yet. Securities designed to offer the stability of fixed income investments with the opportunity for capital growth of equity investments. Examples include preferred stocks and convertible bonds. Those are, which ones? Hybrids, right. The best and the worst of both worlds, right? So you get the best and you get the worst. And what are speculative securities that derive their value from an underlying security or asset? Examples include options, contracts, and futures. People in the cheap seats, come on, you don't have to be right. That's why we're doing it. Hey, good, good. You can make a lot of money. You can lose a lot of money. All right. So now, what are reasonable? These aren't A, B, C, D questions. Reasonable returns from stocks? What are reasonable returns? No, A, B, C, D. What are tell people 8 to 10. That's what we reasonably expect. But some stocks have done a whole lot better. What about bonds? 4 to 8. Right now, they're paying a whole lot less. Short-term securities? Zero. Yeah. No, 2 to 5. Over the long term. The interest rate, short-term interest rates will go back up again. Please, God. Okay. Mutual funds? You don't know. You don't know. Because it depends on what they invest in, right? And then hybrid securities? And you don't know. Derivatives? You're minus something. Okay. What? Well, if you buy a mutual fund that buys stocks, you should get 8 to 10, or you should expect to get 8 to 10, unless you bought a mutual fund that specifically said, hey, you know, we buy utility companies. Well, then you expect to get 8 to 10 from a utility? No. No, I mean, they're not going anywhere, but then again, they're not exploding on the upside like a Farcebook or a Titter. But if you buy a mutual fund that says, we are invested in aggressive growth stocks, what do you expect to get?
High risk.
You're going to get high risk, and let's hope we'll pill 10, 11, 12%. But let's hope and we'll discuss this in detail. Don't worry if you don't understand that now. Remember, you don't need any prior experience. You got some people who throw terms around. Relax and enjoy yourself. Okay, now let's look at some investment returns and risks in detail. So how are we doing for time? Good. I rushed through that a little bit just to make sure we have at least a half an hour. I don't know if we'll get through all of it, but that's okay. That's okay. We're on good footing. Questions, thoughts, ideas? You excited? All right. Over the long term, equities, a.k.a. stocks, have produced the best returns. Now, forget real estate for now. We'll stay with securities. Real estate has actually done better in some cases, but it depends on how you invest in real estate. So let's leave real estate out of this. Stocks, 8 to 10. Bonds, 4 to 8. Cash, 2 to 5. And mutual funds will more or less, often less, reflect the underlying assets they invest in. So we take a look at this graphic from the 6th edition, and we see that over the long term, from about 1925 or so, stocks have really outperformed bonds and treasury bills, which are short-term investments, and inflation. Now, what I want you to do is take the small company stock figure with a grain of salt. The people who created these numbers, it's called Abbotson Associates, Ibbotson Associates. They will even tell you to be careful about the small company stocks. It is true, small companies do better over the long term than large companies. The problem is they exhibit what's called survivorship bias. Have you heard that term? It means these are the ones who lived. The ones who died don't get put into the equation, and there's a lot of them that die. A lot of small companies die. But, of course, every large company at first was a small company. And it makes sense that they would do well. But, hey, Apple started in a garage. Exactly. So just we're going to ignore the small company stocks. And we don't need to see them because, look, what would you rather have over the last 80-some-odd years, 90 years? Stocks, bonds, short-term investments, or put it in the bank and get inflation rate? Yeah, but that's only one side of the coin. We're just looking at the reward. What do we have to look now? At the risk, exactly. And I like this one. This one is over 200 years. And this is what when people jump up and down and say, I want to buy gold. I said, good, let me show you this. When does gold do well? When the world is about to fall apart. If you go back to 1860 in the Civil War, gold spiked. You go into the 1930s, right, in Depression, 1940s. And then what happened is gold inflation started to take hold in the United States, a very unusual thing. Our economy is so large. And gold did really well in the 1970s, only to fall from a high of 800 down to 250 in 1999. And then the world started falling apart in the 2000s. Right? The internet bubble burst, the housing bubble burst, and gold skyrocketed. It hit a high of 1900 about a year and a half ago, and is down to 1200 now. So if you do buy gold, and we'll discuss those much later on, you got to get it right. You got to buy low, you got to sell high, and there are many decades where it'll just languish. But look at what a dollar in stocks has done over 200 years. Now, we don't have a 200-year time frame. Some of you might. The millennials, you might be into eternity, immortality in 100 years. We don't know. We'll see. I don't think I'm going to make it. But what would you rather have, stocks, bonds, short-term investments? Stocks. Okay, but now let's take a look at risk. Risk. Revisit it. It is no accident, dear students, that stocks and bonds have produced better returns than short-term investments. Otherwise, why would investors assume the higher risk of stocks and bonds? Why would you do it? If you could get a guaranteed investment that was going to pay you the same amount as a non-guaranteed, a very volatile investment, meaning you can lose a lot of money, wouldn't you pick the guaranteed investment? Yeah, you would. You would say, why bother going with the risk of stocks or even bonds when I can get the same thing from short-term securities? And so we call this, the term for this, and you should know this, is the risk-free rate of return. In other words, where can we put our money where we will not lose anything? And specifically, when people talk about the risk-free rate of return, they usually are discussing the three-month treasury bill. What is the three-month treasury bill? And that's part of your assignment for Chapter 1. You're going to be looking these things up. What are three-month treasury bills, four-week or one-month? What are savings accounts paying? What are CDs paying? That's part of your assignment. And if we have time, I'll hand them out today. Or if you want to stick around after class, I'll give it to you. But again, I'll give them to you on Tuesday. Plenty of time. So the risk premium is what we expect to receive by picking an asset that is riskier than the three-month treasury bill or something that's just as risky or risk less. So here is a table from your book that shows up until, I think, 2009, from 1925 to 2009, what the risk premium. Now, if it's a little bit tricky, first let's start off at the bottom. Treasury bills, short-term securities, over the last 80, 90 years, have returned about 3.8%. So that's the risk-free rate of return. What's the risk premium? Zero, because you're not taking any risk. Do you think the Treasury is going to default? Some people do. They're wrong, by the way. The Treasury is not going to default. We're still pretty awesome, believe it or not. And so if you pick stocks, again, let's ignore small company stocks, but if you pick stocks, you actually were rewarded with 11.7%. So the risk premium was the difference, 7.9% more by picking a fairly risky investment, large company stocks, specifically the 500 stocks in the Standard & Poor's 500. That's the number they're using. So when we say stocks have done 8 to 10%, we're really lying, aren't we? You know, as a whole, or we should say as large company stocks go, the 500 stocks in the S&P 500, they've done better than 10%. They've done 11.7. In terms of bonds, long-term corporate bonds have returned 6.5, so the risk premium is about 3%, 2.7. And then government bonds have returned a little bit less, 2.1%, above what Treasury bills have returned. Got it? Make sense? Okay, so that's what you have to know. Risk-free rate of return, what's the risk premium? Who gives you the best risk premium? Yeah, forget small company, but stocks. You can just lump them together. But you got to deal with the volatility. Risk versus return. Risk versus reward. Investment return, as we said at the beginning, is very straightforward. How much did you start with? How much did you end with? But measuring how much risk you took to receive that return is much more difficult. In fact, it's impossible. There is no perfect measure. When you and I on the street think of the term risk, we're talking about the possibility of harm, right? Isn't that what you normally use the term? No. We use the term standard deviation to measure risk. In other words, how much does it go up and down? Each year, the investment community measures the average annual return and the amount of variance from the average return using statistics, the resulting measures of risk are called variance and standard deviation. Ay, yikes, paquito. Don't worry, folks. We leave the calculations for your statistics class. But suffice to say, what? Nothing? Okay. Yeah, it's not really that hard. They just use a bunch of Greek symbols so people won't understand you, but it's not really hard how they calculate it. Suffice to say that the higher the variance in standard deviation, the riskier the investment. The higher the variance and standard deviation, the more the investment return will deviate from this average return. You see, do you actually get 8, 9, 10% in any one year? Very rarely. Sometimes it happens, but usually it's 22 minus 4. 7, 15. It varies. It deviates greatly. And we don't have to do the calculation, but here's how it works. These are the individual returns, R sub I, throughout however many years you do it. And what you do is you subtract that from the average that you calculate by adding them all up and dividing by the number of data points. And then you square each one. Why do you do that? Well, you square each one to get rid of the negative numbers. Because if you had positive numbers and negative numbers, they would just cancel each other out. So you square them, and then this thing means sum them all up, add them all up, and then divide by the number of items minus one. Statistics, don't worry about it. That's the variance. To get the standard deviation, you just take the square root of the variance. You don't have to do these calculations, you understand? Don't worry, we just look them up because they're all online. And they're just fancy schmancy terms for you can lose your money. This is a distribution of annual returns on common stocks, the Standard & Poor's 500, from 1926 to 2013. And you can see that 2013 was actually a pretty good year. Almost 30%. Almost broke into, it didn't quite, it was 29.6, something like that. It almost broke into the 30% range. And some years have been very good, 58, 54, 35, 1995, 1997. And some years have not been so good. 1930, 2008. And some people will say, well, you know, 2013 was such a good year. 2014 can't be good. Are they right? No, they're wrong. If you go look at these numbers where you see a year where it was really good, say 1998, you know, 20 to 30%. 1999, another 20 to 30%. You with me? You understand? Yeah. But then sometimes, no. Where's 2007? It's right there was zero, it was like 7% or something like that, and then 2000, can you guess what's going to happen next year from looking at the year you're in? No. Does this remind you of anything, folks? The bell curve, the normal distribution, exactly. The normal distribution, the bell curve, nature has been fairly kind to us, at least to the statisticians, in that most things in nature exhibit the normal distribution. And a normal distribution means there is an average, but there is a wide spectrum of data points. They're not always going to be the average. And the statistics tells us that if we measure one standard deviation plus or minus the average, there's about a two-thirds chance. What we said at the beginning of the lecture, and you didn't understand what the hell I was talking about. But there's about a two-thirds chance that you will be within one standard deviation. So yes, our average annual return has been 11.7%. But in any one year, there's about a two-thirds chance, so 2 out of 3 years, that we will fall one standard deviation below to one standard deviation above that average annual return. So in other words, minus 8.8% up to 32%. There is a 95% chance that you're going to be within two standard deviations. So out of 100 years, 95 of them will be somewhere in here, and then 2008 will come along, and you'll have the 99% chance. And because 2008 came along, and we were out, you know, three standard deviations away, does that mean it's not going to happen for another 99 years? Hell no! You hear people say, well, we just had our 100-year flood, it's not going to happen next year. And then the next year they have a 100-year flood again. And they go, well, how did that happen? Well, again, it's statistics. It doesn't mean, you know, just because this time it happened, there's another 1% chance it's going to happen next year. Investment returns over time tend to mirror a normal distribution. Now, this is from the book, and it's actually not very good. Why? Because it's good in that it shows the wider distribution of the items that are riskier. But the problem is the bars look all the same size. And that's not true. These bars are much higher because there are more data points in the middle. But what I want you to concentrate on is that we see the large company stocks and the small company stocks have a very wide distribution, a large standard deviation. They are the most risky. Nod your head yes. Okay, good. If I'm going over your head, just go like this. You know. And if you need to, okay. And if you need to have a translation in Espanol, hay personas que pueden traducir para ti. Okay, and then we see the distributions getting smaller and smaller and smaller as we go to less riskier investments. Does it make sense? Yeah, it does. It does make sense intellectually. Does it help you emotionally?
No.
Hopefully. It still ain't going to feel good. You know, 2008 ain't going to feel good. But at least you're forearmed and you realize, oh man, this is not fun, but it happens. Here's another view from your book, and if you don't like it, ignore it. But it shows as the standard deviation gets larger, the annual return gets larger. Or maybe we should say it the other way. As the average annual return gets larger, the standard deviation gets larger. Make sense? So you're not going to get this one wrong on the exam, are you? The higher the standard deviation, the higher the risk or the less the risk? Okay, good. Now, what we can do now, folks, is go back and complete the picture. Now we can complete the global picture regarding risk versus return. Who had the best return over the last 40 years? Who had the best risk-adjusted return over the last 40 years? Yes, we did. We are awesome folks. We tend to take ourselves for granted. Mexico is not one of the top 18. Yeah, we call Mexico an emerging economy. Emerging. Which, hey, don't get me wrong. Mexico's doing pretty darn good, folks. And of course, yeah, believe it or not, given all the corruption and all the turmoil and everything, they're still doing really, really well. You go to TJ, and of course you compare it to San Diego, and you say, oh, you know. But go to Honduras, okay? Go to El Salvador and compare Mexico to El Salvador, and you'll go, oh, you know, okay, they're doing a lot better. So look. No, it's the truth. It's definitely the truth. Okay, and you go to other countries around the world, and they think Mexico is, you know, paradise. And they go to the United States, and they're in heaven. But look at the United States. You see, our standard deviation is far less than any other country. I guess the closest one is what? Canada? No. Who's the closest? Switzerland. Switzerland makes sense. Switzerland's the closest one. But Sweden may have had the best average annual return, but you had to accept almost 60% more risk to get that return. And you will hear people, especially people who are just starting putting money in, oh, I'm in it for the long term, I'm not worried. And it goes down 10%. Oh, I'm in it for the long term, I'm not. It goes down 20%. Oh, 30%. 40%. Oh, get me out of here! You know? That's going to happen a whole lot more in Sweden than Netherlands is going to happen in the United States. Are you with me? So, I'm sorry? You know, you say that. It's easy to say, but it's a whole lot worse when you see your $10,000 become $6,000. Yeah. I think about it a lot. You know, and I've experienced it a lot. And I can tell you that it ain't easy. It's not easy. So far, knock on Formica or whatever this stuff is, I've been lucky. You know, I haven't been. I felt like bailing. I felt like bailing in 2002. I felt like bailing in 2008, but I didn't. 2009. Okay. So, does yous got it yet? Does yous got it yet? Huh, folks? I'm not going to be Philadelphia. Yous want high returns? Yous going to get high risk. Yous going to lose some money. Maybe all your money, especially if you go above these guys. And if anybody tells yous differently, they're lying. They're lying. It's a when. Not if, but when you see an advertisement for a 12% safe rate of return, you will know that the chances of losing your money are pretty darn high. When you see claims such as 300% or even 3,000%, and again, you will see these claims. If you're involved in investing, you're going to get on mailing lists, you're going to get these things in the mail or email. You sit on your hands and grab your wallet or pocketbook because these people are trying to rip you blind. By the way, they're breaking the law. You know, we like to think that we have freedom of speech here, but not always. There are some industries where the freedom is curtailed. And in the financial industry, the medical industry being another one, financial industry is highly regulated. And when you make certain claims, you have to be able to back them up. In fact, you have to have them okayed by an entity called FINRA, the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority. And you are guilty until proven innocent, and I can tell you that. They hate the fact that I teach. They just can't understand why does a broker teach? Why are you teaching? Because I love it. Well, what does that matter? You know, it doesn't matter. Okay. And there are people who are out there trying to steal your money. They are going to tell you the most, oh yeah, don't listen to those fools on Wall Street. They don't know what they're talking about. If you're not making 25% a month, you're not following our surefire way. This guy got away with it for 20 years, Wade Cook. And then finally, what does the SEC do? They send them a letter saying, cease and desist. Stop what you're doing. They should come down on them and bang them on the head and throw them in the back of a van and put them in jail. But they don't do that. And then they don't stop. And then they send them another letter. We've told you, you need to stop. And then finally they put them out of business. And what do the people do? They go back and they start another company. So if you go to wadecook.com, they'll say, oh, you know, we're out of business now. But hey, if you were a customer of Wade Cook, come over here and we'll fleece you over here. And these are just a few of them. Do you want to see anybody? Want to see anybody? Yeah. Let's see if we can find Wade Cook. WadeCook.com. Let's see what it says. I should have looked. I didn't bother looking. Oh, now he gave it up. Okay, yes, I'm sorry. I should have looked before. Yes?
Well,
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. Another company is Optionetics. They're still in business, right? Yeah, here you go. Hey, you're one-stop shop. Oh, they've changed the website. There's not as much a free market running. Options basics. Here, classes. Trading essential classes. Are they coming to San Diego? No, L.A. How much? How much do they want? Here it is, folks. Your course materials come complete with the Options Trading Manual, 6 DVDs, Trading Essential Classes. Yes, and it doesn't say the price. It used to say it was $3,495 for a two-day class. And how do you know that these people are screwing you? They've got testimonies, and they took away the testimonies. Testimonies are one of the ways that you can know that these people are really screwing you. When you hear people say, "This is Jimmy B who got 400% on 3 days," it's illegal. They're not allowed to do it. So I guess they've jumped after him. So the testimonies are gone. But here's the guy who on Yahoo was advertising the 100%. Where is he? Yikes. Come on, Payano, where is it? Did you ever have one of those? Here it is. Turn $33,000 into $2 million in just 2 years. Well, it's because he's bald. Only bald people can do it. It's a free book, folks. Only $6.90. And I think, come on, man. You know, give me a break. So here, this is what you have to have done to turn $33,000 into $7 million. You would have to have returned 25% per month, or 1,356% per year to turn $33,000 into $7 million. Now, if you have inside information, which is what a lot of movies have been based on, you can do it overnight. But you could go to jail. Okay.
That's happened to Martha Stewart, right?
Oh, it happens. Oh, yeah. It happens. A guy at one company will get a call from somebody else saying, "Hey, Chuck, you know who this is, right? Don't say anything. Buy Apple or sell Apple." And then, boom, Anaconda Steel or whatever. Yeah. Buy Amalgamated Consolidated. Now. And hang up the phone. And the next day, an announcement comes out that this company is going to be bought by another company, and the stock price zooms up, and this guy makes $1 million overnight. And then the SEC's computers come back and say, "Oh, this doesn't look good," and they investigate the guy, but he had nothing to do with it. How would he have known? Does it happen, folks? Oh, yeah, it happens a lot. So, hey, it's part of the landscape. Well, no, she did that on purpose. Yes, she did.
She went to jail
on purpose. I know it's the truth. Oh, yeah. Her publicist, we're talking about what's her name? Martha Stewart. Her publicist said, "Do some jail time. You'll be in there 3, 4, 5 months, and you can't buy that kind of publicity. They'll have you on television showing the convicts how to make turkeys or whatever." And sure enough, what happened to the stock after she got, whoa, right. But you're in the, yeah, right, smart woman, really smart. She, you know, by the way, she used to be a stockbroker. She knew what she was doing, yeah. In the back of your mind, you're saying, "But wait a minute, isn't somebody doing it? Isn't somebody making tremendous rates of return?" The answer is yes. There are people out there, folks. They are not investors. They are traders, not traitor, but traders or speculators. And you can get a job trading. It is very difficult. Some people do it on their own. That's even more harder. Being a trader can be very profitable, but it is also very stressful and perilous. And you are up against the best in the business. And I'm going to read you a little story right now. I hope you don't mind. But unfortunately, they took out the interview. If you click on it, now all you see is here. There used to be an interview here. But this guy, John Bogle, is the gentleman who basically made Vanguard what Vanguard is today. It's the world's largest mutual fund company. People love it. That's unusual. Right? People really love the company they deal with. And they've done a lot for shareholders. And he says it so succinctly. And he chides us, the educators of the world, for not making this distinction. And I want to go, Mr. Bogle, I do it, sir. He says, the first thing you got to ask yourself is, are you an investor or are you a trader or a speculator? If you're a speculator, then what you're doing is you're deciding, I see this stock is $10 or this bond is whatever, or this whatever, I'm going to buy it. The gold is at this amount. I'm going to buy it at this price and sell it at this price or this price. If you're an investor, you see a company that you like. The numbers look good. The future prospects, they're well run. You own a piece of that company, just as you would go out and buy a pizza shop or a shoe shop, and you hold it forever, and you enjoy the fruits of what our capitalist system can produce. And that's what I'm going to focus on. If you want to be a speculator, I'll do my best, but I can't really help you. Because I'm certainly not a speculator. Every time I tried to do it, I've failed miserably. Started out good every time, and then fell into the porcelain oasis. So what I'm going to do right now is read you a little story. So I hope you'll beg my indulgence. But it's a story of two of the titans of Wall Street in 1980s. I need my glasses. Whoa. It's called Liar's Poker. It's on the website, too. There are two individuals. The one guy's name is John Goodfreund, which is a German name, but I'll just say good friend because it's hard to say Goodfreund. But it means good friend in German. And the other guy's name is John Merriweather. Okay. It was sometime early in 1986, the first year of the decline of my firm, Solomon Brothers. Our chairman, John Goodfriend, left his desk at the head of the trading floor and went for a walk. At any given moment on the trading floor, billions of dollars were being risked by bond traders. Goodfriend took the pulse of the place by simply wandering around and asking questions of the trader. An eerie sixth sense guided him to wherever a crisis was unfolding. Goodfriend seemed to be able to smell money being lost. And they talk about how well he was thought of in the industry, that he was on the cover of a Business Week, and usually just hovered around. But this day in 1986, Goodfriend did something very strange. Instead of terrifying us all, he walked a straight line to the trading desk of John Merriweather, a member of the board of directors of Solomon Incorporated, and also one of Solomon's finest bond traders. He whispered a few words. The traders in the vicinity eavesdropped. What Goodfreund said has become a legend at Solomon Brothers and a visceral part of its corporate identity. He said, one hand, $1 million, no tears. One hand, $1 million, no tears. Merriweather grabbed the meaning instantly. The King of Wall Street, as Business Week had dubbed Goodfriend, wanted to play a single hand of a game called Liar's Poker for $1 million. He played the game most afternoons with Merriweather and the six young bond arbitrage traders who worked for Merriweather and was usually skinned alive. Some traders said Goodfriend was heavily outmatched. Others who couldn't imagine Goodfriend as anything but omnipotent, and there were many, said that losing served his purpose, though exactly what that might be was a mystery. The peculiar feature of this challenge was the size of the stake. Normally, the bets didn't exceed a few $100s. Now, you have to remember, in New York, it cost $100 for lunch, $200 for dinner. So it's not unusual for them. $1 million was unheard of. The final two words of this challenge, no tears, meant that the loser was expected to suffer a great deal of pain, but wasn't entitled to whine, bitch, or moan about it. He'd just have to hunker down and keep his poverty to himself. But why? You might ask, if you were anyone other than the King of Wall Street, why do it in the first place? Why challenge Merriweather? It's a sheer act of lunacy. Meriwether was the king of the game, the Liar's Poker Champion. All right, now, let's see, keep going. Now, the whole obsession, John Meriwether had in his course made hundreds of millions of dollars, put billions of dollars now, it's 30 years ago. He had an ability, rare among people and measured by traders, to hide his state of mind. Most traders divulge whether they are making or losing money by the way they speak or move. Emotions, right? They are either overly easy or overly tense. With Meriwether, you can never ever tell. He wore the same blank, half-tense expression when he won as he did when he lost. He had a profound ability to control the two emotions that commonly destroy traders, fear and greed. And it made him as noble a man who pursues his self-interest so fiercely can be. Okay, the best businessman in the place, the best risk taker, a very dangerous liar's poker player. And Gutfreund was not a very good liar's poker player. So, let's see. Now we have to go around. Okay, now, what is liar's poker? It's a group of people, as few as two, as many as eight or ten, form a circle. Each player holds a dollar bill. You take a dollar bill out of your pocket, and you look at the serial numbers. The game is similar in spirit to the game known as I Doubt It. Each player attempts to fool the others about the serial numbers printed on the face of his dollar bill. One trader might make a bid, three sixes, which means all told the serial numbers of his dollar bill and all the other dollar bills contain at least three sixes. You see? So you know what's on your dollar bill, but you don't know what's on anybody else's dollar bill. Once the first bid has been made, the game moves clockwise in a circle. Let's say the bid is three sixes. The player to the left can do four sixes, or he can do three sevens. Okay? The bidding escalates until all the players agree to challenge a single player's bid. Then and only then do the players reveal their serial numbers and determine who is bluffing whom. In the midst of all this, the mind of a good player spins with probabilities. What is the statistical likelihood of there being three sixes within a batch of, say, 40 randomly generated numbers? The math, though, for the good players is the easy part. The hard part is reading the faces of other players. The complexity arises when all players know how to bluff and double bluff. The game has the same feeling of trading. The question a liar's poker player asks himself, up to a point, are the same question a bond trader asks. Is this a smart risk? Oops, wrong page. Is this a smart risk? Do I feel lucky? How cunning is my opponent? Does he have any idea what he is doing? And if he's not, how can I exploit his ignorance? If he bids high, is he bluffing? Or does he actually have a strong hand? Is he trying to induce me to make a foolish bid? Or does he actually have four of a kind himself? Each player seeks weaknesses, predictability, and patterns in others and seeks to avoid it in himself. The bond traders of all the firms on Wall Street did it, but the bond traders of Salomon Brothers were considered the kings. And the code of the liar's poker player was something like the code of the gunslinger. It required a trader to accept all challenges. Because of this code, which was his code, Meriwether felt obliged to play. But he knew it was stupid. For him, there was no upside. If he won, he pissed off his boss. No good came of this. If he lost, he was out of pocket $1 million, which was far worse than upsetting the boss. Although Meriwether was by far the better player of the game, in a single hand, anything can happen. Luck could very well determine the outcome. Meriwether spent his entire day avoiding dumb bets, and he wasn't about to accept this one. "No, John," he said, "if we're going to play for these kind of numbers, I'd rather play for real money. $10 million, one hand. No tears."
Wow.
$10 million. It was a moment for all the players to savor. Meriwether was playing liar's poker before the game even started. He was bluffing, of course. Gutfreund considered the counter proposal. It would have been just like him to accept. Merely to entertain the idea was a luxury that pleased him well. It was good to be rich. But on the other hand, $10 million was, and still is, a lot of money. If he lost, he'd only have $30 million left. His wife was busy spending the better part of $15 million redecorating their Manhattan apartment. Meriwether knew this. And Gutfreund was the boss. He wasn't clearly bound by the Meriwether code. Maybe the whole point of his challenge was to judge Meriwether's response. So, good friend declined. In fact, he smiled his own brand of forced smile and said, "You're crazy." "No," thought Meriwether and all the bond traders in the Solomon Brothers trading floor, "just very, very good." So you ready to go up against John Meriwether? Yeah? Okay. Well, I'll do my best to help you, but I'm not that good. Oh, we're not done yet. Hang on a minute. Just a couple more slides and we'll be done. I timed it well. I don't want to waste any of your time here. So, what is a realistic rate of return for me? After you have taken this course, you will have a strong knowledge of the most popular types of investments. Stocks, bonds, cash, mutual funds. You will also know what levels of returns and what levels of risk you should reasonably expect to receive. And if you are a patient, you can sit down, unless you want to stand. Okay. If you are a patient, long-term investor, I believe it is realistic to expect 8 to 10%, unless the world falls apart. I'm certainly working on it, and so far, so good. Of course, as we will reiterate time and time again, there are no guarantees. But is that good enough? Is 10%, is 9% good enough? It turns out it is. If you can stick with these ifs, you start early, you millennials. You're patient, consistent. You don't get too cocky. Don't get too greedy. Don't chase after every next big thing that comes along. And most importantly, you don't panic when the market swoops. Hugo sure is not going to panic. That's what he told me. As it inevitably will do from time to time. The trick is to take advantage of the time value of money. Now, we're not going to do these exercises. They are on the website. And the answers are on the website. And I might show them to you next Tuesday. We will do the reverse. We will do present value of money. Some of you have already done these in the Business 121 class. So, let's not do them. But one last comment. You want to, as best you can, avoid large losses. Because the numbers going up ain't the same as the numbers going down. What would you rather have? An investment that does 85% but loses 50? Or an investment that does 10 and then 9? Everyone says A, usually. Well, it's still up at 30%. Doesn't work that way. The numbers going down are far worse than numbers going up. Sure, the first year, $100 becomes $185, only $110 here. But the next year, 50% drop. Yeah. So you want to avoid large losses. You're going to have, if you invest in stocks, there are going to be some times when you have large losses. So it's going to happen. And one last question. The greater the variance in standard deviation of the average annual returns of an investment, the greater the risk, the less the risk. There's no correlation. Standard what? Okay. Don't get this wrong on the exam. Okay, no football this weekend. Study. Next Tuesday, unless you want to come over, I'll give you the handout for the assignment. We go through short-term investments and then onward and upward. Okay, and if you want to crash, come see me.